Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. I'm John Ford. Here's what's ahead. Cheap hope. That's what one analyst says is the bull case for Intel right now in its attempt to revitalize the business. We're going to ask why the kitchen sink approach, as you might put it, isn't enough. Plus, the social giants set to testify again in front of Congress. We will get an inside look at the questioning that we can expect. And GameStop's Nothing Burger earnings report sends the stock sinking. But we begin with today's markets overall. Dom Chu with those numbers.
The markets overall are continuing a near-term trend, John, where we're seeing some outperformance in the Dow and the S&P, perhaps a little bit of underperformance for the Nasdaq composite. As you can see here, the Dow Industrials, 32,704, the last trade. They're up about 284 points, about 1% decline or advances up there, 0.5% advances for the S&P 500. Meanwhile, 0.75% declines for the Nasdaq composite. That level stands at 13,133 and change. Now, one of the big technology stories driving some of that Nasdaq and S&P trade is what's happening with the semiconductor stocks. If you look at the S&P 500 versus the semis, it's been a huge performance gap between the two. Take a look at that, 101% advance there for the semiconductors. Now, we're seeing a little bit of that give back today, but again, bullish news on semiconductors could be one of those leading indicators for us. The market, we'll see if that trend plays out. And maybe the stock move of the day so far, it's an eye-catching one to the downside. Viacom CBS, we've been telling you for a couple of weeks now that this has been one of the best performing stocks, media or otherwise, in the S&P 500. The best performer over the last year entering yesterday's trade. It's now down 18% today after a big decline yesterday. That brings its total decline to roughly 27% from the highs we saw just 2 days ago. Remember, Viacom CBS saying that they could raise they will raise $3 billion of new share capital through a stock sale, convertible stock sale. So that news sending Viacom CBS shares down. This was a $101 stock just 3 days ago, John. Viacom CBS, certainly one to watch. I'll send things back over to you.
Indeed, Dom, thanks. Meanwhile, Intel unveiled its biggest comeback plan, including a $20 billion investment to build two new chip plants in Arizona. I spoke with CEO Pat Gelsinger in his first broadcast interview as the company's new CEO. Asked him how we're going to know whether he's on track at the end of this year.
We're going to give indicators along the way and, of customers that have committed to the foundry. So some of it will be customer counts. You know, I'll probably give some metrics around how many wafer start commitments we have to customers. You know, things that allow investors to say, okay, they're doing what they said they would. And as you've seen from me as CEO at VMware, you know, we want the say-do ratio to be extraordinary for the path of the company going forward. We're going to say something, and then we're going to over-deliver against it in a consistent way. So some of those early indicators are going to be super important because they're also going to be ones that we want to get out there, not just to satisfy investors, but to build confidence in the customers. And if customer X hears that Y and Z have already committed some of their designs, oh, that's going to build confidence on their part as well.
Now, this ambitious move to expand comes at a time when demand is outweighing supply. But I asked Pat if this strategy poses a risk to the company if the gap between supply and demand closes.
I believe that the world has a 10-year good cycle in front of it, John. And when you think about, you know, every industry is becoming more digital, right? Every aspect of education, of healthcare, of automotive, you know, our human existence is becoming more digital. And COVID was a big accelerator to that trend that was already underway. So first, I believe this is a robust market for many years to come. Clearly, there's, you know, different gaps in supply and challenges that you work through. But we're leaning into that because these capacity decisions need to be made years in advance. And part of our current shortages are the decisions that the industry didn't make several years ago. So we're saying we're going to lean into that aggressively.
Joining me now is Stacey Rasgon, a senior semiconductor analyst at Bernstein. Stacey, you're literally not buying it, keeping your $43 price target on this stock that's at about 63. It would seem that if there's any time to sort of bet on Intel. Now would be that time. Why are you unimpressed?
Well, yeah, I heard you referring to cheap hope. So like that is the, the phrase that we've been using for a while. It's not just.
But if it's cheap, why not buy it? Expensive hope. Isn't that worse?
Well, look, in tech, by the way, cheap is never a reason to buy a stock all by itself. Just like expensive is never a reason to sell a stock in tech all by itself. Like you need more than cheap. Now you do have the hope piece of this. And by the way, like I like Pat. And this is one thing that Pat's been very good at doing. Pat can bring hope, right? He's been doing the stocks up, I don't know what it is, 25% or something since he took the job. And he can give credibility. Like he's more capable of correctly judging the risks and the opportunities from whatever the opportunities are in front of him versus, say, the prior management team. Maybe he can do something on the HR side and keep talent there and everything. So these are all good things that Pat can do. At the same time, it's sort of interesting. The part of the bull case on the stock like 2 or 3 months ago was they were going to go fab light. And now it's like we're going to double down on everything. And we've been having execution issues, but we're going to fix those execution issues. Plus, we're going to outsource more. Plus, we're going to enter this brand new business, which is massively capital intensive, and go head to head with TSMC and execute on everything like cleanly where they haven't been able to do that before. Like it's a lot to take in at this point.
It is.
I think the hope is going to be that, and by the way, I think that the general, transition economics are going to get worse. I mean, they already lowered guidance this year. You can actually see in the gross margins and free cash flow, the economics are getting worse. My guess is that hasn't stopped. The hope is going to be that like with Foundry or with everything else, that they can give some certainty for what a trough earnings will be and that it won't go lower. And that on that number, the stock's still inexpensive enough where you can take a flyer on the long term. That's kind of what I mean by cheap hope. The problem right now is we don't actually know what the trough earnings are.
Right.
The revenues right now are inflated. And I know he was talking about a 10-year cycle, which by the way, he's probably right. But like PCs are running at levels that were close to the 2011 peak, like after a year or two. I don't think
Let me ask you the inverse of the question that I asked him. Because if I step back, interest rates are low. There's more reason than ever for the U.S. government and government in Europe to support exactly what Intel is trying to do. He is, on paper, the guy for this job. But as you point out, they have failed at Foundry before, and the full-year guide doesn't look great. So how will we know if Pat Gelsinger is failing at the end of 2021?
Yeah. And this is interesting, by the way, because he got there, I don't know, 5-6 weeks ago officially. They didn't throw this together in 5 or 6 weeks. They hadn't been working on this before, but I don't think Bob Swan could have sold this to the street. Like Pat can, right? He's got that credibility. So that's probably one reason Pat had to go. In terms of the subsidies, you're absolutely right. And by the way, this is not a dumb thing that they're doing, right? If there's any time, we got a perfect storm in semis right now where they can take advantage of this and they can actually get external subsidies from the government to do this, that's great. I'm less convinced that it's all going to the foundry business. I mean, even if they're building out foundry, initially it's going to be very, very small, right? Like those dollars, that capacity they're building will be for themselves. And then over time, as foundry grows, it'll take more and more of that. So, and then if foundry fails, I mean, they don't have to give the tools back. So if, in some sense, if they've got a structurally higher CapEx, they're $20 billion they're guiding for this year is for themselves. It's not for the foundry business. If their CapEx is going to be running that high, if they can actually get some money from the government to help offset them, that's not a dumb thing. That's a very smart plan in that sense. But in general, like I said, the costs are going up. The economics are going to get worse. And we'll just have to see kind of what they say in terms of monitoring this stuff. But I mean, we're really not going to see anything in terms of actual numbers that you can really tie into for until 2023 or probably even beyond that. And the roadmap for the next several years is baked, right? The AMD story, they're still going to be taking share. Apple's still going to be moving away. You've got ARM getting deployed in much bigger numbers, both in PCs and the data center. Like, that is all going to happen. Yeah. There's no way to stop it. And those are just based on decisions that were made several years ago, just like the capacity decisions that he was talking about.
You know, hard to argue with what you're saying.
I will say what's interesting about the Microsoft story over the past decade was that the multiple expansion came before the real shift in numbers. The story there and the street believing that story also had a big impact. Stacey, we've got to leave it there for now. Quite a lot for investors to take in, whether to eat these chips. Stacey Rasgon. Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, and Sundar Pichai testifying before the House Energy and Commerce Committee tomorrow on misinformation on their platforms and what might be done about it. The CEOs releasing their testimony today. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg saying, quote, "We are committed to keeping people safe on our services and to protecting free expression, and we work hard to set and enforce policies that meet those goals." Meanwhile,
Twitter's Jack Dorsey says, quote, our efforts to combat misinformation, however, must be linked to earning trust. Without trust, we know the public will continue to question our enforcement actions. Joining me now are two members of the committee demanding answers, Representative Mark Vesey, a Democrat from Texas, and Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican from Oklahoma. Welcome to both of you. Representative Mullen, what's the most important thing that you think we can actually learn from this process, aside from sort of the posturing that we sometimes see here and the testimony that's already been written down?
Well, one thing we don't want to hear is the CEOs once again just tell us excuses and say we weren't aware of that and we'll get back to you. We've had them in front of the committee before. They've testified to in front of us before. We were concerned about censoring at that point. They're protected by Section 230, and Section 230 is very open. It means that you're not monitoring the content. This goes back all the way to the public square where you literally hammered and nailed your messages down, and the people there were, that was providing the property or the post, they weren't held liable for what was said. We've extended Section 230 to these platforms because we've seen it as the modern day public square. But what we've seen with Facebook, what we've seen with Google, what we've seen with Twitter is that they are continuing to monitor what is said, and they're choosing to remove posts that they deem not acceptable. Well, that's not what Section 230 does. It provides an open platform, and they're not the ones to monitor that content. And there's a difference between disagreeing with a view and having a vulgar or something unacceptable posted there, such as a sexual content or something that is immediately inciting violence. But just because you don't agree with someone's political view, you can't remove that. And so we're going to be asking those questions to the CEOs of these companies and ask them how they're defending it and how they come up with how they're going to monitor it at the same time, why they should still be protected by Section 230.
And Representative Vesey, the companies are going to say, we don't remove posts because of people's political opinions. As a matter of fact, the Democrats are arguing that we leave that stuff up too much. And as a matter of fact, we remove stuff when there's harm threatened to individuals, things like that. It seems everybody's attacking 230, but nobody seems to agree on how to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, and it, look, it's tough to fix it, right? I mean, you want to try to keep these platforms as open and as free as possible. But also, these companies need to be held accountable when they do things that put the public's safety and health at jeopardy. I think that it's, very serious when you think about the way how they monetize a lot of this behavior that can lead to even other things like discrimination in the areas of housing and employment. I also think that, look, there's a ton of conservative content that's on all of these platforms. If you go to Twitter or Facebook, you find all of these guys that are on talk radio that also have these sites. I think that what the companies need to do is to make sure that we don't have repeats of what happened on January the 6th. And they do have an obligation to make sure that they are not allowing content on there that can lead to us having a situation at the Capitol again where we had people that were killed, including a police officer and a mom.
So we sort of heard two ends of this to some extent. And Congressman Mullen, even aside from Section 230, look at Parler. They weren't really having a heavy hand by any stretch of the imagination in monitoring the content. And Amazon Web Services said, you know what, that's a problem. Apple said, you know what, that's a problem. You're not behaving according to our terms of service. So even if you're not dealing with 230, I think there are questions around appropriateness according to the standards of tech platforms. Are there not?
Well, there is, but that's when you get into antitrust. And I think these companies are also going to be looking at antitrust issues too, which I get we're not digging into that. And energy and commerce, and tomorrow we probably won't even be talking about antitrust, but these companies need to know that if they continue to choose who can and can't be on their platform by the simple fact that they don't agree with what they're posting or their content that they're posting or allowing to be posted, when these companies are protected by Section 230, that's an issue. When you start, and Mark is a good friend of mine. I mean, Mark and I, we fly back and forth to D.C. all the time. We've known each other for a long time, and we get along actually great. And so we agree with what we're talking about. What we agree, disagree on what content should be removed and who's monitoring that. For instance, when you look at what Twitter and Facebook did to New York Post when they wouldn't let the Hunter Biden story be posted, when that was actual factual. These are two or the New York Post is a credible media outlet, and they wouldn't allow them to post a story. How is that not censoring the content that is there? When you have Candace Owens that was removed from removed from Twitter when she criticized the governor of Michigan about the mask mandate. That's her opinion. She's voicing her opinion. That's called free speech. And they removed that content.
Interesting, that though, in the context, we did have a known threat on the life of the governor of Michigan attached to those very sorts of comments. So I'm sure that's how the social networks would counter.
But Candace Owens didn't voice that. It wasn't her.
But that's the environment in which it stood. Congressman VC, you know, clearly this, though you're friends, we're not coming to agreement here. What progress do you think can be made coming out of this hearing?
I think that they need to be able to articulate to the committee, you know, how they're going to be able to continue to have a platform where people can share information and it can be open, but it's not to the detriment of people's health. I mean, there's things right now going that are being spread around on Facebook, for instance, urging African-Americans to not get the vaccine for COVID-19. And a lot of this information that's being spread throughout Facebook and Twitter is false. It's saying all these things that are going to happen. And look, it needs to be fair and open, but should people be able to put things like that on there? No, they shouldn't. I don't care if conservative content is on there. Again, there's a ton of conservative content on there. But I do think that when people are using it as a to weaponize lies and misinformation, then I think that the sites absolutely do have an obligation to pull it down, whether it's on the left or right.
Yes. Well, Facebook has said as of last month that they aim to take down misinformation on vaccines. Not sure how that applies to opinions, but thank you, Congressman Mark Vesey and Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the bond market seems to be stabilizing this week, yields actually moving lower. So does that mean the tech sector is getting ready for a rebound? We will ask. Plus, cruise lines have new plans to get around CDC guidelines and hit the seas. It's good news for the industry, but potentially bad news for U.S. jobs. We've got the details.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Rates have stabilized somewhat over the past week, despite all of the Fed speak since last Wednesday. On a day when the 10-year yield is remaining calm, you'd expect the NASDAQ to be in the green, along with the Dow and S&P. It looks like the NASDAQ missed that memo. It's down about 1% after weeks under the influence of rising rates. So what accounts for the disconnect today? Joining us now is Abe Deshpande, Chief Investment Officer for Centerstone Investors. Abe, is the tail still wagging the dog here with yields and the NASDAQ and tech stocks, or is there more to it?
There's always more to it, right? and so I think in this case, maybe there's a couple of things that are happening. One is that the economy is opening up, and that's really the main thing, right? The economy is opening up, and it's pushing yields up because there's expectations of inflation, all these bottlenecks everywhere. And at the same time, the stay-at-home trade is you know, people are rethinking that because of the obvious consequences of opening up the rest of the economy. So what looked like a one-to-one sort of correlation, that as bond yields go up and NASDAQ goes down, I think those are actually separate things. They happen to coincidentally be related, but the main the common thread is the economy is just opening up. So you can actually have, and probably will have, scenarios like this that we have today, where you, rates are flat, the NASDAQ is weak, and vice versa. You know, the things that will drive interest rate trends don't always drive stock trends. You know, for instance, the long bond market can be manipulated by the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And there can be bubbles in stocks, which we've had, clearly had, for the last few months.
So speaking of, you guys at Centerstone focus on value. You're global in your view. So, yeah, things are opening up. And so one might think, let's look at the sorts of companies that are going to benefit from that. But a lot of those companies have had a nice run already. So how do you determine where value is within that cohort?
Yeah, I mean, they've had a nice run from, you know, 60%, 70% off, right? I mean,
right.
Frankfurt is a good example. That's an airport operator in Frankfurt. You can guess what happened to the stock. It went down a lot, but it went from 100 to 30. And the stock's trading at 50 now. I can make a good case that there's a lot of value there, well in excess of the current stock price, just the asset value. And that's what's wonderful about value investing is we don't have to look about, you know, 20 years down the future about what battery demand is going to be or whatever electric car demand is going to be. Value investing is about the here and now. It's the bird in hand versus the two in bush. And there's a lot of birds in hand potentially right now in the value space, despite this big run-up from the last 6 months or so.
All right. Nice. The flip side of GameStop. Abe Deshpande, thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, entrepreneur, CEO, and author Arianna Huffington joins us for a look at the gender pay gap, why the pandemic might have halted progress against it. And Mark Cuban enters the NFT world. We got those details. Be right back.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big?
Ooh.
Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, 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 click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Stocks are mixed, with the Dow seeing its biggest gains and the biggest one-day gain in 2 weeks. The NASDAQ in the red, nearing session lows. Let's check the sectors. Energy, industrials, and materials are your leaders. Communication services and tech, your laggards. Here are some of the movers this hour. Alcoa moving higher on an upgrade to overweight at Morgan Stanley. This on raising its target from $20 to $43. General Mills lower on an earnings miss. Revenue did beat, but disappointing organic growth in North America was one of the weak spots. And take a look at some of the at-home stocks. Peloton and Zoom, both under pressure today. Peloton down more than 8%. Now to Rahel Solomon for a CNBC News update. Rahel.
Hi, John. Hello, everyone. Wow, that's a new shot there. 13 state attorneys general are suing the Biden administration over its energy policy. They want to end a pause in new oil and gas leases on federal land. Louisiana's attorney general says that the halt on new leases is raising energy prices and also costing jobs. And Boulder, as people continue to mourn the fatal shooting of 10 people at a supermarket, a first court date has been set for the suspected gunman. He's expected to face a judge tomorrow morning. And see how the Boulder community is coming together in the wake of that shooting tonight on the News with Shepard Smith. And Americans celebrating Easter are expected to spend a record amount on the holiday this year. A poll from the National Retail Federation says that consumers will spend on average $180. Gifts, food, and candy show the biggest increases, with total Easter spending expected to hit $21.6 billion. And John, I can tell you that I already have friends who have already bought candy, not for their kids, for themselves.
Okay.
No judgment.
A couple days ago, you were talking about the pounds that people have put on during the pandemic, so maybe all of this ties together.
Don't be judgy, John.
I don't know your friends. All right, just saying. All right. Thank you, Rahel.
Sure.
Coming up, GameStop seems to believe that less is more. Cars meet crypto, plus sailing past regulations. That's ahead in Rapid Fire. The Exchange is back after this. let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar. It's time for Rapid Fire. Here with their takes, Bob Pisani, Seema Modi, and Robert Frank. First topic, GameStop shares plunging down more than 19% on disappointing earnings and lack of detail from executives on the call. GameStop did announce former Amazon and Google exec Jenna Owens is going to take over as COO and disclosed it might sell shares to fund its digital transformation. The company provided no information on its transformation plan, though, and no questions were allowed on the call. Bob, you said this call was a nothing burger?
It was a nothing burger. I mean, really, what happened to all of this talk about a digital transformation? Nothing. No earnings call. They read a statement and they just hung up on everybody. Everyone was ready to start asking questions and there was nobody there. They just hung up. I think the most important thing that happened today is they're considering selling additional shares. But this is a very different thing. At the market offering, it's called. And you can do an offering of this up to 100 million shares at any time, then stop or start it. That's not like a traditional secondary here. Here, you don't have any fixed number or a fixed price or a fixed time. So all of a sudden, you could have additional shares on the market very, very quickly. The last thing, John, the volume is terrible today. It's one-third normal volume here. So what we have is not a lot of sellers, but not a lot of interested buyers at the same time, which is why the price is down. I think people are really having a hard time figuring out what the right price is for this company.
Robert, we've been watching this stock for a while. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, it seems like all of Wall Street that loves volatility is probably all over this stock, but a lot of it comes down to Cohen.
Yeah, it does. Look, I just hope that the Reddit traders with diamond hands also have iron stomachs, because there is no sign that the Ryan Cohen revolution is happening or even starting. This is a company that has had 9 straight quarters of sales declines. Forget about profit declines. 9 quarters of sales declines. And I also thought from a Wall Street perspective, it was interesting. The secondary offering was assigned to Jefferies. Jefferies upped their price target yesterday to $175. The rest of the street is at $25. I would never say that their research is influenced by their banking relationship. But it's interesting that most of the street has a $25 price target on this thing.
Yeah, you can't even buy a video game for that. Right. Next up, cruise lines rallying today after getting hit yesterday amid concerns over new lockdowns. It comes as a trade group is asking the CDC to allow sailings from U.S. ports to resume by July. The group argues they should be treated like other travel companies, and the July timeline is in line with the president's comments that Americans should be able to gather in small groups again by Independence Day. But at least one company has a way to get around all this. Seema, you've been following this for us. What's going on?
Yeah, so John, you can really feel the frustration of these cruise lines, and that strongly worded statement to the CDC urging them to allow them to lift sail here in the United States in early July. Till they get that, some cruise lines are saying we're not just going to wait around. Royal Caribbean is launching 2 new sailings, one out of Bermuda, the other out of the Bahamas. These sailings will not stop at U.S. ports. Instead, they'll take advantage of their private island, Coco Cay. The one out of Bahamas will also stop in Mexico. The only challenge I could foresee, John, now if you're sitting in Kansas and you're a loyal cruise passenger, instead of just booking a flight to Miami and then getting on board, you now have to book a flight to the Bahamas. It may cost a little bit more. It's also a longer flight. You then have to test negative for COVID before getting on board. You also have to be vaccinated if you're above the age of 18. So we'll have to see what bookings really tell us about the demand for these type of sailings. But it really just showcases how these cruise lines have had to get a bit creative on getting in front of their passenger and also taking advantage of that crucial summer sailing season.
Robert, that's a lot of hoops to jump through. You think enough people are itching to get back on a boat?
I am consistently surprised, John and Seema, how throughout this crisis, you know, we had sort of a false start last year where we thought we would maybe get cruising in the fall. How many signups there were? I mean, after everything that's happened, you know, even pre-COVID about the health and safety of being on these cruises, there are more people than I ever estimate that just love to cruise and can't wait to get back. And this is also huge for Florida and its economy, so they need it too.
Well, there's some hardcore cruise people. Like, they love to cruise.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And then this. Elon Musk is really, really embracing crypto. Musk tweeting, "You can now buy a Tesla with Bitcoin." He clarified the payment option is available only in the U.S., but it's going to be available internationally later this year. Tesla shares are down today. They're down more than 20% since Musk revealed Tesla acquired $1.5 billion in Bitcoin last month. I mean, Bitcoin, I think, is up since then. Robert, a lot of billionaires that are talking about Bitcoin and crypto and Dogecoin, and I'm not sure whether we should follow the billionaires this time.
I don't know either. There are two funny things about this. The first is that people have been buying expensive cars with crypto for years. There was a great story in 2017. A guy bought a Lamborghini for 45 Bitcoins. Now, he had spent $115 for those Bitcoin that then translated into a $250,000 car. He was proud of it. But those Bitcoins today would be worth $2.5 million. So he gave up 7 Lamborghinis by giving up the currency. There's also an issue with the tax. Let's say you buy a $70,000 Tesla. You're paying $14,000 in capital gains tax, perhaps, by trading in the Bitcoin, because anytime you buy anything with Bitcoin, you pay a capital gains tax. So cash always makes more sense than Bitcoin, whether you're buying a car or a house.
Bob, should you buy GameStop with Bitcoin?
I don't think so. And I agree. Bitcoin is certainly not a very viable payment system yet. One thing, some people are thinking Tesla's tied to Bitcoin. I don't understand that at all. When did they make that announcement? I think it was February 8th. Tesla's down noticeably since they made that announcement. Bitcoin is up noticeably since they made that announcement. So there's that's certainly not tied to Bitcoin's fortunes at all. I think Tesla's a lot more tied to situations like higher interest rates and some concerns about future cash flows related to higher interest rates than it is to Bitcoin right now, though.
All right, one more. Another day, another celebrity getting into NFTs. This time, it's Mark Cuban. Cuban telling The Block that he's building out a digital gallery called Lazy.com. It's currently being beta tested. It's going to allow users to display their digital art all in one place. No word on an official launch. NFTs caught the attention of big names from Time Magazine to quarterback Patrick Mahomes, who you saw right here on the exchange. Seema, I think this is coming around to physical display. And I know Cuban's gallery here is partly digital, but, you know, this is going to be about real stuff eventually.
Yeah, we got to see this display at the Met one day. That's when we know the NFT market has truly arrived. What I like about this idea, John, is that Cuban seems to be not just launching an NFT like every other celebrity or high-profile investor, but instead trying to create, I think, in addition to a museum, a marketplace, right, to sort of view the different NFTs and digital art that is around us. Over time, if he can create that into sort of an e-commerce platform in some ways, that could be really interesting so more people have access and know where to find this digital art.
And Robert, do you know who Medicoven is yet? And I mean, you know the super rich better than anybody. What good is spending millions of dollars on something if you can't show it off?
Yeah, now you've been making that point all along, and it is such a good point that all these billionaires are now catching up to, John, which is that you buy a trophy asset to be a trophy to show off, and now they're doing that. Medicoven, who has revealed his identity, he's Indian living in Singapore. He's building a lot of these through his company Metapurse, these virtual museums, and he has announced recently that he's going to build a special museum for this Beeple piece that he bought for $69 million. So I do think it's going to be a trend when you buy these things to find a place to display them. The other thing about Mark Cuban is he has a lot riding on NFTs. He's a big investor in Mintable. He's an investor in OpenSea. Those are both trading platforms. And as an MBA owner, he gets proceeds from the Dapper Labs collaboration with the NBA. So he's invested perhaps more than anyone and has investments riding on the future of NFTs. So
yeah,
he's talking his book, but I also think he's building something that's valuable.
Bob Pisani, give us your closing take.
You know, the big point here is the collectible market for everything is exploding. And the question is NFTs really a unique asset, like collecting posters or comic books, something like that? And they're acting like it is. I don't know if it is. I don't understand the debate about the prices or $60 million. I collected comic books in the 1960s. The first Superman sold for $1 million in 2010. And everybody said, who's going to spend $1 million for a comic book? Somebody did. That comic book now routinely sells for $2 to $3 million.
So do you have it, Bob?
It's worth what anybody is willing to pay for it. No, not that one, but that comic book you could have bought for $5,000 in 1969.
All right. Well, I hope you got some good ones. Thank you, Bob Pisani, Seema Modi, and Robert Frank. Still ahead, it is Equal Pay Day here in the U.S., which aims to raise awareness of the ongoing gender pay gap between men and women. Up next, we will speak with Arianna Huffington about that and more. The Exchange will be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Today, March 24th, is Equal Pay Day because this is how far into 2021, from January 1st, 2020, women have to work to catch up with what men earned just last year. Julia Boorstin is here with details and a special guest. Julia.
Thanks, John. Well, women were paid 82 cents to every dollar paid to men as of 2019 census data. Now, the gap does vary by race. Compared to white men, Latinas are paid 55 cents on the dollar, Native American women 60 cents, and Black women 63 cents on the dollar. Now, that's one reason the pandemic is hitting women so hard. The National Women's Law Center calculates that the more than $10,000 typically lost to women annually as a result of the pay gap could have paid for over a year of groceries at a time when over 12 million women have said they do not have enough to eat. New analysis finds that the gender pay gap actually narrowed over the past 12 months from 81 cents to 84 cents. But that does not mean that women are being paid more, but rather that women lost jobs in low-paid sectors such as retail, leisure, and hospitality. And that wage gap is forecast to widen again later in 2021. Now, joining us now is a woman who has made equal pay one of the many issues she champions, multiple-time founder and CEO Arianna Huffington, founder and CEO of Thrive Global. Arianna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Julia. Great to be with you.
So, Arianna, of course, Thrive consults to companies about how to improve their employee well-being. And I know you have a new book coming out on that very topic. But before we get to that, let's dig in here on equal pay. You've written about this in the past. How should companies be thinking about the importance of closing pay gaps?
So what we think is very important with all our work with Fortune 500 companies, Julia, is to look at the pay gap in the larger context also of the fact that women still carry a disproportionate amount of work at home. And during the pandemic, when our homes have become the most important place combining work, family, school, women have been so unequally burdened that we've seen over 2 million women having to leave the workforce. So this is an opportunity to really address a systemic injustice, both in terms of pay, but also in terms of how work is divided, in terms of what we call the mental load women have to carry. And we've launched a program called Working Families that really disrupts work-life integration and creates an entire organizational system that divides chores more equally based on an ownership model than on can I help you with lunch, dear, model. And it may sound like small micro steps, but we believe we need to start taking these small micro steps at home, and we need companies to encourage this work-life integration so that women are not just paid unequally, but also carrying a larger part of the burden.
Yeah, crucially, the work-life integration for men as well as women. You make a very good point that you can't talk about this issue and not talk about the whole workforce, all employees. So right now, with this inequity widening over the course of the pandemic, as more women leave the workforce, what is your recommendation to companies right now, especially as some companies are hiring again, some are entering more of a hybrid work environment?
Well, again, Julia, this is part of the larger reckoning post-pandemic, which is also a huge opportunity to redefine productivity and recognize that well-being and productivity are interconnected. So we see now multiple employers who work with, whether it's Bank of America, Accenture, Salesforce, Hilton, making well-being central to what they are doing for their employees, giving cultural permission from the top. So it's no longer just an HR, warm and fuzzy, nice to have benefit, but intimately connected with business metrics like attrition, recruitment, and performance. And we even had this new SEC rule, which is quite groundbreaking, asking companies, mandating actually, that companies report on what they are doing for their human capital in terms of attraction, development, and retention, which again puts well-being, mental health, mental resilience at the center.
Very interesting. Now, you're just this week releasing this new book that's based on all the data that you've gathered from your corporate clients. What are your recommendations to companies right now and to employees, especially as people reenter the in-person workplace?
So, Julia, the book, which is called Time to Thrive, is based on a principle of micro steps. We find that a lot of companies, a lot of executives are so overwhelmed. There are so many demands on their time that if you ask them to do anything to improve their well-being and their performance, it overwhelms them even more. So we've broken it down into what we call micro steps too small to fail. And there are hundreds of them in the book. And everything based on the latest science that shows that, in fact, if we start these new micro steps, we build new, healthier, and more productive habits. And let me give you my absolute favorite, which is based on the latest neuroscience that shows that it takes 60 to 90 seconds to course correct from stress. Like anybody who is watching now is stressed. You know, we're not going to eliminate stress from our lives, but we can eliminate cumulative stress. We can avoid that simply by having the 60-second resets, as we call them, during the day, between Zoom meetings, after you received stressful news, before you go to bed, 60 seconds before you go to your phone in the morning. So in our work with companies, we put reset at the center, including with the call centers, Julia. You know, call centers are some of the most stressed out parts of our economy. But if you feed these 60-second Thrive calls to the operators, it really changes both their stress levels and customer success.
Well, I hope, Arianna, as people return to the office, that it proves an opportunity for employees and companies to make some reset decisions. Arianna Huffington, thank you so much for joining us today on this Equal Pay Day. John?
Thanks, Julia. Now, still ahead, with more than 45 million Americans now fully vaccinated, offices, schools, and venues are looking to bring people back. We'll talk to the CEO of a software platform that helps with contact tracing and verification of vaccination records. We'll learn what reopening might look like next. Microsoft announcing it is planning to phase workers back into offices starting this month, joining the likes of JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Walmart. But with vaccine distribution still underway, cases going up in a few areas, companies are looking to implement extra safety measures. That's where the software platform Cleared4 can help. It offers symptom monitoring, contact tracing, and vaccine verification for employers and venues like Yankee Stadium looking for a safe way to reopen. And joining me now to discuss is Cleared4 CEO Dr. Somi Inchimpati. Dr. Inchimpati, what's your assessment of where we are right now? You know, a quarter of the population, I think, has at least one shot of a vaccine. How careful do we need to be, and how does Cleared4 fit in?
Sure, we need to be very careful. Cleared4 fits in because it's a flexible software platform that helps society reopen. But the key is not to just reopen. The key is to reopen safely and, importantly, stay open. We use the modification of a previous platform that was used for ER triage. So we're already in this platform of using health to determine access control. Since then, as you mentioned, we've been partnering with the Yankees and Angels, but also a lot of other venues such as offices, schools, and corporate events. And recently, as you mentioned, yes, we have incorporated testing and vaccine verification, which will be very important components of safety going forward.
So how practically is this going to work for, you know, say a corporate campus that's looking to open back up? Maybe in the past, you swiped your badge to get into a building, and that was the end of it. What are the added pieces that a system like Cleared for the software platform can help to monitor, and what else needs to be in place for it to do its job?
Sure. So the office is a great example, but we use our platform to really be agnostic, and we can integrate into anything. We don't have a traditional app per se. We're really the middleware that integrates into other people's apps and other people's software platforms, such as corporate websites, et cetera. So we use our software to identify who the person is. We use the health information that they put in, and then we follow the business rules for each individual client. For example, in New York State, there'll be different rules for the offices to come back than in other states. And so we use the individual states and the individual business rules of each facility to really perform what the company or the client of any sort of it's a venue do to get back into the office and reopen.
What's your expectation and how long this software and these processes remain a part of our society? Some people might say, well, by the time most people are vaccinated, we don't need this anymore. Why should we continue paying for it?
Well, there's a lot of issues here, and what you answered is a very layered question. And so if you think about it, there's so many issues that are relevant to your question. One is, what's the rate of vaccination? You mentioned 24-25% now, with 14% getting both shots already. But this will roll out over time. And so what will be the ultimate by August? Will it be 60%? Will it be 90%? We don't even know. Mm. There's, if you look at the polls, about 40% of people really are still reluctant to get vaccinated. And we'll see how that is after the summer, when people see that it's fairly safe to do. On the other hand, you also mentioned how long we'll be living with this. And I think the key there.
And it could be a while. I definitely get your point. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. But thank you, Dr. Somi Ichampati.
Okay, thank you.
And that does it for The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.